From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a Michigan priest faces accusations of sexual assault from several young men who used to work with him.
All three of them have remarkably similar stories, that Pearl recruited them, that soon after they arrived, he started aggressively trying to have sexual relationships with them, and they say that when they refused him, he retaliated against them.
Also, a medical historian on the extraordinary global effort that brought us the COVID-19 vaccine in less than a year.
It wasn't about being first and who gets the credit. There's no Jonas Salk in this story, because there's hundreds of Jonas Salks in this story.
And Paul Mitchell becomes the second Republican congressman from Michigan to split ties with the GOP.
It sends a message to the Republican leadership that people like him are not happy with an unwillingness to play the game by the rules.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, a venerated Michigan congressman leaves the Republican Party, citing the path it has taken under Donald Trump. Paul Mitchell is the second to do so in a 2-year period. We'll have more on that story coming up later in the show. But first, we want to take you back to a warm June night in 2019, when a young Polish priest at a Michigan seminary got a call from his boss, the very Reverend Canon Mirosław Kroll. According to a federal lawsuit that was filed yesterday, the young priest says that by this point, Father Kroll had been sexually harassing him for months. But he did not know the night would end with him driving an intoxicated Kroll and another visiting priest to a motel to meet a male sex worker and getting cash from an ATM to pay the man. These are among the explosive allegations outlined in the lawsuit against one of the leaders in Michigan's Polish Catholic community. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells has been reporting on this and spoke with one of the three men accusing Kroll of abuse. Hi, Kate.
Hey, April.
We'd like to note as we begin that we're going to be discussing some incidents of sexual abuse in specific terms, so this discussion may not be appropriate for everyone listening. Kate, for those who aren't very familiar with this part of the Catholic Church, who is this priest who's been accused, and how is it different from some other similar accusations we've heard about within the church?
Yeah, so Father Mirosław Kroll is the chancellor and CEO of Orchard Lake Schools, which is a campus in Oakland County that includes a seminary for training priests, mostly Polish priests, a 4-year preparatory academy called St. Mary's, and a cultural center called the Polish Mission. And this place has been around since the 1800s. It's a big part of Polish Catholic culture and history in the community. It originally started as a way to train priests for all the Polish immigrants coming to Detroit. But in recent years, like so many parts of the church, you know, they've really been struggling to recruit new priests and keep fundraising going. And the guy who did that for them pretty successfully, by all accounts, is this outgoing, energetic priest originally from Poland named Mirosław Kroll. There are a lot of videos of him on YouTube in the ornate robes and masses and fundraisers, including this one mass last year that was celebrating his 20 years in the priesthood.
You know that we priests can be attacked by the devil spirits. We are attacked. The devil exists. But the devil at the end is going to be a loser. The devil will lose because we have the power of Christ. And I beg you, my dear brothers and sisters, as lay people, support your priests, support vocations, that we have the strength that comes from the grace of God to say no to those temptations.
So these allegations about Father Kroll that went public in these documents yesterday, they don't just threaten Father Kroll, who we should note denies all of the allegations, but this is a really hard moment for a very close-knit community that has looked to this guy as this real beacon of what they were trying to sustain, you know, a flourishing, living continuation of this long Polish Catholic tradition in the U.S.
So who are the three men named in the lawsuit accusing Father Kroll?
All three are anonymous. They're using pseudonyms. Two of them are priests who were recruited to the seminary by Kroll. The third is a lay person. He was actually the director of the Polish Mission Cultural Center until he was fired earlier this year. And one of the priests, known as John Doe 3 in the complaint, we should note, he is not technically a plaintiff, but he's serving as a witness who can sort of speak to this pattern here. And all three of them have remarkably similar stories, that Kroll recruited them, that soon after they arrived, he started aggressively trying to have sexual relationships with them. And they say that when they refused him, he retaliated against them, either forcing them to resign or firing them. And they say that there is a history here of Orchard Lake leadership. We should note the Archbishop of the Detroit Diocese is a trustee of part of Orchard Lake, getting reports about Kroll, but looking the other way, or even being part of that retaliation process. Orchard Lake denies all of this and says that the men are mischaracterizing the circumstances regarding their terminations.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the plaintiff who was the director of the Polish mission? I understand he's a professional musician. He lived in Chicago, was born in Poland, and Kroll recruited him to come to Orchard Lake. What does he say happened then?
Yeah, so I talked with him last week. He was at his home in Chicago, and he was actually sitting out in his car in his garage because his daughter was inside doing virtual school, and he wants to try and protect her from as much of this as possible. In the complaint, he's called John Doe 2, and he says, in the weeks after he started at Orchard Lake in 2018, Kroll starts inviting him to his apartment in the evenings. And that several times during these visits, he says Kroll would get drunk and try to have sex with him, telling him he wanted him or trying to kiss him. And at one point, even putting his hands down his pants and masturbating in front of John Doe 2. And John Doe 2 says at first he tried to just avoid the situation entirely, but that soon it really got out of hand and he started talking to some colleagues at Orchard Lake. And he says they told him, well, you know, actually there have been rumors about possible misconduct from Kroll years ago.
There are people who heard about it already long time before I got even to Orchard Lake and didn't do anything about it. Like you waiting for what? For something really crazy happens here on the campus, you know? So, and then even I heard from someone, oh my God, thanks God that you are straight. You are not the gay. You are not having a relationship with Father Kroll, because that was the gossip.
Eventually, though, John Doe 2 says that this becomes too much, that Kroll becomes increasingly aggressive. And he says that he reports this to a board member of Orchard Lake, who then gets his permission to tell the rest of the board about these allegations. But according to the complaint, that board member is quickly forced to resign. And Doe 2 says that he got a email soon afterwards, abruptly terminating his contract and accusing him of financial impropriety. They were accusing him of misappropriating funds from the Polish mission, which he denies.
What about the two priests who are named in the complaint? What are they alleging happened to them?
The complaint is painting this bigger picture that Kroll was going to Poland, recruiting would-be priests who had to leave seminary in that country for one reason or another, maybe because they were gay, maybe because they had issues with alcohol. And they're alleging that Kroll would invite them to come to Orchard Lake. And once there, they may not have spoken much English. They were really dependent on him. If they wanted to be priests, he was really their only path forward at that point. The priest who is known as John Doe won in this lawsuit. He says Kroll actually recruited him from a parish where he was working in New Jersey to be vice chancellor at Orchard Lake. And he says, actually, he also promised to arrange for this priest's green card, which never materialized. Instead, he says Kroll would invite him to his apartment. Again, you're noticing a similar pattern here. And at one point, Kroll puts his hands down this priest's pants, touched his genitals. He says Kroll was also really controlling, verbally abusive, and that one night Kroll called him drunk and had him drive himself and another visiting priest to a gay bar, then to a motel to meet a male sex worker, and then get cash from an ATM to pay that sex worker. Kroll, again, denies all of the allegations in the complaint, but there is a third man in this complaint, as we've mentioned, John Doe 3, and he says that he was also sexually harassed. Same pattern, that when he rejected Kroll, Kroll began sending him abusive text messages and firing him.
What's the response been from Orchard Lake and the Archdiocese of Detroit?
So in this complaint, one of the priests, this last priest we just mentioned, he says that after he was abruptly fired, he wrote to the Archdiocese and told them what was going on. And we should note that the Archdiocese of Detroit is a separate entity from Orchard Lake. But that soon after he'd written to the Archdiocese, a detective with the Michigan Attorney General's office, which is investigating Catholic sex abuse cases, reaches out to him interviews both him and one of the other priests. We reached out to the Archdiocese's press office yesterday when the case was filed. We still have not gotten a response from them. One interesting note in this case, in the bigger picture here, is that Kroll trained under and was ordained by the now disgraced former American Cardinal, Theodore McCarrick, who of course has become notorious for his years of being promoted within the church while he was sexually abusing minors and seminary students. And the lawyers for the plaintiffs in this Kroll case are trying to tie Kroll and McCarrick together, essentially saying, well, you know, Kroll used these grooming patterns that he may have seen McCarrick using, but that's speculation. Orchard Lake says that they have put Kroll on leave, although he's still their chancellor and CEO. And they sent us a statement saying these former employees are mischaracterizing the circumstances surrounding their terminations, that their claims lack merit, and that Orchard Lake follows the highest standards for our students, faculty, and staff.
There's a lot here. I wondered if the ages of the victims, the fact that we're talking about people, priests who were involved in the seminary or the Polish mission, if that at all colored the way that Orchard Lake or maybe even the Archdiocese handled this.
I mean, again, we would just be purely speculating here because all we have is the story of these three men to go on at this point. And yes, all of them were adults, and that is important to note. But if these allegations are accurate and that this was in fact repeatedly reported to the Orchard Lake Board of Trustees, then there really isn't an excuse for why they continued to look the other way. You know, these men in this complaint are saying that really their lives have been impacted pretty terribly. The man who was is still the Chicago musician and the cultural mission director says Kroll went on a Polish radio show and essentially said that he'd misappropriated those funds from the Polish mission and that word spread very quickly. And he starts getting calls from, you know, people he's known for years and years and years. And he says he really worries that, you know, someday his daughter is going to grow up and hear these allegations about him. And it's just, he feels very alone and like he has come away from this really with his name ruined. One of the priests also says that Kroll has been calling and threatening his family and friends, and that his people in his parish where he works now in New Jersey have been getting these letters disparaging him and saying bad things about him. And he believes that those are coming from Kroll as well.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. You can read her whole story at michiganradio.org. Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you, April.
In just a minute, some thoughts on the COVID-19 vaccine and the truly remarkable speed at which pharmaceutical companies were able to develop it. That's after a short break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This past weekend, the first doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine left the production plant near Kalamazoo. Some who watched the convoy of trucks roll out got a little emotional, and not without reason. This historic moment has brought hope to a year full of disappointment and mourning. We're checking in today with Dr. Howard Markell, a medical historian at the University of Michigan. We're going to talk about the history of vaccine production and what that can mean for us today. Howard, it's great to hear your voice.
Nice to hear yours too, April.
What was your reaction when you saw the images of those trucks in Portage leaving for their destinations?
Well, if I was wearing a hat, I would have taken it off in respect. It is a historic moment because there has never been a faster process from discovering a newly emerging infectious disease and getting it all the way to a workable and usable vaccine in basically under a year. That is a world's record in the history of medicine and vaccines. So it's utterly incredible what they've been able to do.
Knowing what you know about vaccine development and production, I mean, was that a surprise to you? I mean, we knew that pharmaceutical companies were basically all hands on deck for this, but are you surprised at how fast this came together?
Yeah, because it's a difficult virus. It's an RNA-based virus, and we haven't had the best success with that. Another RNA virus, of course, is HIV. We don't have a vaccine for HIV, although we do have pretty good medications for it. So there was a great deal of science, technology, and ingenuity that went to this that developed it far faster than I would have predicted 9 or 10 months ago.
You've had access to some of the research information that maybe wouldn't make as much sense to the layperson. Could you give us a plain English explanation of how this was done so fast?
Well, that is a great question. You know, first of all, there's really three or four different products emerging that work in different and highly technical immunological ways to make the body, the human body, immune to a subsequent infection. But because the science was shared and people were working around the world on this process, scientists in Germany or Israel or China or Russia, as well as the United States and so on, could all communicate and work with one another from the point they discovered the actual genome of this virus very early in the proceedings to the point of today. It wasn't about being first and who gets the credit. As you can find, there's no individual there's no Jonas Salk in this story, because there's hundreds of Jonas Salks in this story. So just as everything else in our society seems to be jet propelled and far faster than it's ever been in the past, we're learning that vaccine production has benefited from the same speed.
The thing that seems analogous to this is the polio vaccines rollout and vaccination in terms of a national effort, national information campaigns, and really a national response. By comparison, yes. How fast was the polio vaccine mass produced?
In a way, you know, our first American polio epidemic was in 1916. FDR didn't found the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis as a nonprofit, nonpartisan foundation to not only help people who had polio, but to find a vaccine in 1938. And it wasn't until 1955 that the Salk vaccine was announced at the University of Michigan in Rackham Auditorium that it was safe, effective, and potent. So that's a matter of many years. Now, the science, of course, was less advanced and the process was different, but it took many, many years to do that. And the Salk vaccine was ready in 1954, but a very careful field trial of 1.8 million children around the country was orchestrated by Thomas Francis at the University of Michigan for the National Foundation of Infantile Paralysis, or as we better know it, the March of Dimes, a very appropriate name, because they funded it, not the government, not other groups, all of us, all Americans who gave their pennies, nickels, and dimes. So you see a, quote, March of Dimes to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue to lick polio. 1955 was also a very different time in that there was great trust for our government officials, for scientists, and for doctors. You know, after April 12, 1955, every American parent wanted his or her child to become Jonas Salk.
Do you think the fact that polio was so serious as a childhood illness had an effect on how people perceive this?
Yeah, there's no question that polio's primary target of children really helped round the troops toward a singular goal. But the fact that it was a different era where there was much greater trust, less disinformation, less avenues for disinformation than this current vaccination process, I think made it a lot easier. We already know that about half the country is against the COVID vaccine because of not only anti-vaxxer sentiment, but even political grounds. So there's a real challenge with doctors, public health officials, government leaders, and others to get everyone vaccinated for COVID, because that is the only way we're going to kill this violent enemy.
Howard, as folks may have heard, the Pfizer vaccine needs to be super cooled, not just refrigerated, but refrigerated at a temperature far below what a lot of facilities short of hospitals may not have done before.
Yeah. South Pole kind of temperatures.
Yeah. I seem to recall that the polio vaccine also had some specs. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of challenge that was at the time?
There were challenges in manufacturing the polio vaccine, even though Salk
developed a method along with his colleagues at University of Pennsylvania. But the federal government granted six different departments to make polio vaccine, and they were up and running after the announcement was made. It was an inactivated formalin-killed virus vaccine. So while it needed to be preserved, it didn't need these particular deep freeze temperatures. Now, on one level, the government required a preservative called methylate to be added to Salk's vaccine, and that lowered the efficacy rate. And in fact, Salk complained about that. There also was the infamous Cutter incident a few weeks after April 12, 1955, when parents were literally pushing their kids to the head of the line to get their polio vaccine. The Cutter Labs was a company in Berkeley, California, and it was really a slapdash, inappropriately controlled factory where Jonas Salk's right-hand man, a man named Julius Younger, went out and said, "What's going on here? I mean, there's rooms where there's live virus in some vats next to other vats that have killed virus." He really worried about it, but it didn't go very far until they began to notice that many batches of the Cutter Lab vaccine was tainted with live vaccine. Tens of thousands of people got some form of polio. About 200 were actually paralyzed, and maybe 10 died. So they took all of that Cutter vaccine off the market quite quickly. They regrouped, they reinstituted better quality controls, and in a matter of weeks, they resumed the mass vaccination of children. Can you imagine if something like that happened today with COVID? It would stop everything dead in its tracks.
There's enough fear and suspicion out there about vaccines already. I mean, it seems like that would be very dire.
It would stop it dead. It really would. So, you know, we're going to have enough problems with just mild adverse effects. You know, every vaccine has some mild effects, headache or feeling like you have a cold or under the weather. But we tolerate those because the risk of getting COVID is so much greater, so much more deadly than the mild risk of feeling crummy for a day or two. But even those can be misused by the disinformation campaign. So we really have to be careful with how we give the vaccine, how we monitor side effects, and a daily briefing about what's going on and what's working and what's not working and how we're going to make things work.
We know that about 6 in 10 Americans have said that they would be willing to get the COVID vaccine. That's promising. But there is that 40% of people who have reservations at this point.
Yeah. Let me throw a little rain on your parade.
Sure.
About those 6 out of 10. Okay. In the middle of a pandemic. And that, too, is striking about this vaccine, that it's being developed in the middle of this remarkably, you know, this probably the second worst pandemic in human history, is that while 6 out of 10 are saying they're going to consider getting it now, when there's plenty of vaccine finally available for everybody, and that's going to take a couple of months to, you know, to early or late spring, let's face it, we might see fewer going to get the vaccine. That happens all the time with flu vaccines, for example. In 2009, in the early days of the flu pandemic, 90-odd% of Americans said they would take the vaccine. When it was ready 9 months later, less than 20% got the vaccine. Here's another bit of rain on the parade. The Pfizer vaccine requires 2 shots. When I was practicing pediatrics, I used to call that the pediatrician's nightmare, because a lot of people won't come back for the second.
So what do you think should be the sell for people who are feeling skeptical about one of the various COVID vaccines in this moment?
The sell is this. This vaccine has been vetted carefully by the best minds in vaccine science, immunology, infectious diseases in the world. These are careful men and women who are very well trained to do that. While no biological entity is 100% safe, this one looks to be very, very safe, and it's one I would give myself or my children. The second issue is this. This virus is stealthy and deadly, and it also plays a game of Russian roulette, because even when you contract the virus, you don't know if you're going to be the one who gets sick or just transfer the virus to somebody else, and you don't know if you're going to get sick enough to be hospitalized and potentially die. And as long as we don't nail it, and that means a herd immunity of, I don't like 70%, I frankly like 80 to 90%. If we don't do that, this virus is going to become endemic and we're going to see fires here and then there and then somewhere else for years to come. So all of the people involved on the science end, on the public health end, on the medical end, they have done a miraculous job. And now it's time for us as Americans to unite during this crisis and do our own miraculous job by rolling up all of our sleeves and getting the vaccine twice, because it needs to be a two dose when it is ready and available.
I wonder, is there any concern in your mind about people maybe feeling a certain sense of exuberance now that the vaccine is starting to be available and maybe doing things that are less safe because they feel like the worst of the danger has passed?
Yes, I do worry about that. And the message is this: we are not out of the woods until hundreds of millions of us. In fact, there's 3,800 million Americans, give or take a few thousand. And I want as many of those 3,800 million to take the vaccine. We're not out of the woods until we get vaccinated. That is the only thing that's going to knock this virus out. And that means until that day that it's available for all of us, we have to continue social distancing, mask wearing, staying close to home, and staying safe.
I know that you've been extremely busy with requests for scholarly articles and essays and all manner of things, and interviews like this one during the course of this year. I know that when you first set your research path into medical history, and especially the history of infectious disease, you probably couldn't quite have foreseen everything that's happened this year. But what's it like to be so on trend?
Well, my daughter says it's kind of cool. You know, it's been the honor of my life. It's been the honor of my career to help explain this terrible tragedy just a bit more. Did I know it would get to this point when I started 30 years ago? No. But when I started doing this research on social distancing about 15 years ago, I knew it was important, but I never wanted a terrible worst case scenario pandemic to try it out. Now that this is happening, it's been incredibly rewarding and gratifying to know that our research helped develop social distancing. And those countries or those places that have ignored it have failed miserably as a result. But it's also been horrifying because hundreds of millions of people have gotten sick from this. And so many of us, myself included, have lost family members to COVID-19. It's been a very interesting time for me.
What are the ways in which the pandemic has challenged you? I mean, I know, as you mentioned, you lost your mom this year, and I'm so very sorry about that. But are there ways in which the conundrum of the virus has been hard for you?
You know, I was saying this to my sister the other day. My mother died in late February, and it was before the shutdown. So we actually could have a funeral, like a real funeral. And I mentioned I was grateful for that. You know, I wasn't happy she died, of course, but I was grateful it didn't happen several months later. But it's only in the recent weeks I've been dealing with my mother's, payments and things, estate kind of stuff. And I have her death certificate in front of me, and it really hit me like a ton of bricks because I've been so busy with, you know, as you said, interviews, writing, committee work, and so on, that I haven't had the time to properly grieve. And I know this is going to be a very weird thing to say, but I'm grateful for the COVID virus for me to be so busy in a way. But it's been challenging. You know, I haven't seen people I love. I do talk to them by phone or by FaceTime. I'm very fortunate that a great deal of my work can be done remotely.
But mostly this has made me very sad because, and frustrated, because we know what works. We know how to hide from this virus, but we haven't had the resolve to do it. And I have to say, I might get in a little trouble for this. As a doctor, as a physician, my first priority is and always will be life. And the economy was hurt no matter what. It was hurt when we did social distance. It was hurt when we didn't social distance. But I have to say, above all, as Hippocrates said, first, do no harm. And so it's very frustrating in various states, in various institutions, that people wanted to proceed business as usual or try to do that. And many, many more got sick and or died because of this terrible virus.
Dr. Howard Markell is a medical historian at the University of Michigan. Howard, I know that the holidays are going to be very, very bittersweet for you this year, but we wish you and your family all the best.
Thank you, April, and I wish the same to you and all of your listeners.
Coming up, a group representing religious schools is suing the state over COVID restrictions. In just a moment, we'll hear the group's arguments for exemption.
We believe we can do that in a safe manner and consistent with their constitutional religious liberties.
That's next after a break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A federal court in Western Michigan is considering a lawsuit by some of the state's faith-based schools. Like all educators, these Catholic and Protestant institutions are in the midst of a shutdown for grades 6 through 12 under orders from the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. Younger kids can still attend class in person at the discretion of each school system. But the Michigan Association of Non-Public Schools argues in its filing with the court that the upper grades should be allowed to return to the classroom as well. Brian Broderick is the executive director of the Michigan Association of Non-Public Schools, which brought the suit, and he joins us now. Hi, Brian. Welcome to Stateside.
Hi, April. Thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation to talk with you.
What is your argument for sending the older kids back?
Well, we are interested in making sure that our schools are able to continue with their COVID-19 preparedness and safety plans. They've been effective. We've been able to safely educate students, you know, K through 12. In particular, we have been able to safely educate the 9th through 12th graders, the high school students that are currently prohibited from being in person. And we believe we can do that in a safe manner and consistent with their constitutional religious liberties.
So of the 25 schools listing new outbreaks in the month of December, it looks like from the state's latest numbers that 16 of them are faith-based. I don't know that that's disproportionate to the number of faith-based schools in the state, but at minimum, it certainly seems to imply that faith-based schools are not immune to the outbreaks that have happened in some places, and not just among high schools, but also among elementary schools, too. How can we say that it's safe enough for kids to go back?
Well, absolutely. No school is immune from having an outbreak, which is defined as two cases. And I would agree with you on that point. Our point is that when there have been outbreaks at non-public schools, that they have been, or at least our membership, the man's membership, which are the Catholic, Lutheran, and Christian schools, they've been dealt with in a proper way. So students have been told that they had to stay home. They've been isolated. There have been contact tracing. There's been work done with the local public health department to make sure that any incidences of COVID-19 are identified, and that the students and the faculty and thereby their families are kept safe. We're not arguing that COVID-19 isn't present everywhere, no matter where you attend school, or possible to be present where you attend school. What we're saying is that our schools have spent thousands of dollars in preparedness plans, and we address the matter on a local basis, and we think that the decision should be made on a local basis whether or not a school or a classroom should be shut down. I might add that the list from the state, and I'm not going to dispute the accuracy of it, you were going to find, I think you're going to skew more towards non-public schools being on the list, because non-public schools more often than not are in person compared to public schools. So naturally, the incidence of COVID for a non-public school would probably skew a little bit higher just by the fact that they have been in person for the most part for a greater degree than public schools have.
We've heard from a number of school officials that it's just been very difficult, nigh on impossible, to maintain face-to-face operations given the need to find substitute teachers and alternate methods every time somebody has an exposure. With the degree of community spread we have in Michigan right now, that's been very difficult. What makes you think that your members are going to be able, I mean, is it worth the fight to try to get face-to-face classes back, given what will inevitably happen when people start testing positive?
Yeah, absolutely worth the fight. And I don't disagree with you that these things can happen at non-public schools as well, in terms of the difficulty of finding substitute teachers and you know, taking care of all the protocols that need to take place. Our point is that where this happens, and when it happens at one of our MANS member schools, the appropriate steps are being taken to isolate those individuals, to have them in quarantine, to get the students who were in contact with the student who has COVID or faculty member that has COVID, those folks are quarantined as well. And we're able to do it in an effective manner. What we want to say is, let these decisions be made at a local community level and not necessarily blanket closures dictated by the Department of Health and Human Services. That's why if there's an incident, no one is saying that our schools are going to open immediately upon a court order and recklessly say all students come back in and we're not going to offer potentially a hybrid situation or remote learning. We want that ability to make those decisions at the local level. And it's important because we are offering something, a religious education that's protected by the First Amendment. And so there's a little bit, a degree of difference there, I think, than just kind of your standard education, that we have a religious component to the education, and in person, the ability to offer that in person is critical for its success.
What is not happening with distance education with respect to faith formation that would be happening if kids could be in the classroom?
There's a lot of different things. I mean, there's just a lot of concepts that are involved in faith formation and in religious schooling that are, you know, sort of sacrosanct and unable to be carried out in an online format. There's the whole concepts of, you know, redemption and reconciliation, the practice of virtues. There's a great benefit for students in faith-based schools to sort of have the culture of a faith-based school is sort of imbued much more successfully when students are able to have it in person. They can see if there's members of the clergy that are part of the teaching staff. They get that interaction with faith-filled teachers on a personal one-on-one basis. And then there are other things, you know, particularly with regard to the Catholic faith, that simply have to be done in person, like receiving the Eucharist or reconciliation, confession. There are certain things that you can't do over a Zoom platform or any other sort of online platform that require folks to be, or students to be in person with the adults.
It's the Archdiocese of Detroit just sent out a message that Archbishop Vigernon has extended the dispensation that says that people can, in good conscience, decline to attend Mass on Sundays and holy days of obligation until at least Ash Wednesday of 2021. You're saying that we should be sending kids to class so that they can take communion when many, many people in churches all across Michigan are looking to their health and choosing not to?
Sure, if otherwise safe. I mean, I understand what the Archbishop has sent out. I think he's also part of that directive is that if you are able to attend Mass and receive the Eucharist, that you should. So if you're somebody who's out and you're going to, you know, the grocery store or shopping or doing other sort of activities, secular activities, that you would, that dispensation from Mass necessarily wouldn't be as absolute unless you have some, you know, serious health concerns about going into a church or a house of worship. And similar with schools, currently, right, our schools are offering, when they were allowed to be open, the ability to have remote learning as well as in-person learning. So it's not dictating necessarily that all students have to be in person. It's creating that option for those students and those parents who feel it's important for their student to be able to attend a faith-based school and get that faith formation component that's critical and really the reason why parents select our schools.
Michigan's faith-based schools have sometimes lobbied and lobbied successfully for public funding. Is it consistent to make that argument and then to say, our schools should in turn be exempt from rules by MDHHS or maybe other departments within the state?
I guess you'd have to tell me where we receive public funding for faith-based schools receive any public funding to make that distinction. I think it's consistent with the ability of faith-based schools to operate and to be able to form students in the faith. It's consistent with the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And I think that you know, that fact and what we're asking the federal district court judge in Kalamazoo to rule on, that's something that is consistent and something that's, you know, of primary importance to students who attend any of our MANS member schools.
Just to clarify, the case over private schools getting reimbursement for complying with health and safety orders is before the Michigan Supreme Court. That case is still pending.
Yeah, that case is still pending. And our schools aren't disputing that there is a regulatory structure that our schools have to comply with. We think that the regulatory structure that is being abused or misused currently under the Department of Health and Human Services order closing all high schools. So we're not disputing the fact, and our schools have not disputed the fact that they need, with regard to the current pandemic, that they need to wear masks, that they need to have social distancing, that they need to do the proper cleaning protocols. All of our schools are doing that. We've all filed plans with the state as required. Our schools, with regard to the mandate reimbursement, that argument is, yes, we have a regulatory structure here that requires our schools to do certain things under Michigan law, and that is asking for reimbursement for those items, for those things that are required by state, because they're really about health and safety of children, not necessarily the ability to attend a faith-based or a non-public school.
Brian Broderick is the executive director of the Michigan Association of Non-Public Schools. Brian, we know this has been a really tough time for everyone working with students right now. We wish your members all the safety and all the best this season.
Thank you very much.
Yesterday, Congressman Paul Mitchell, who represents the Thumb region of the state, announced that he's leaving the Republican Party over its inability to accept the results of the 2020 presidential election. He said so in a letter to GOP Party Chair Ronna McDaniel and added that the party is on track to cause long-term damage to democracy. Paul Mitchell was retiring this year anyway, but he joins Justin Amash, another rep from Michigan, as the only two members of Congress to abandon the GOP over its shifts in the Trump era. Let's listen to Paul Mitchell speaking on this show after he announced his retirement from Congress amid criticism of the president.
That's the problem here. So people worry first about elections, about winning elections, and first, foremost, and sometimes only. And that is one of the issues that we're dealing with here. It's nice if we actually solve a few problems.
With us to unpack the story is Rick Pluta, Capitol Bureau Chief for Michigan's public radio stations. Hi, Rick. Would you remind us of the career path that led Paul Mitchell to Congress?
Yeah, he was not a previous office holder. He is a very wealthy man who put a lot of his own money into his campaign, which is not unusual, although he is one of the wealthiest people in Congress. And like a lot of wealthy people, when they get to Congress, that they find out that it's not an individual endeavor, that it's very driven by partisanship, by the conference that you're in, and loyalty and playing along is an expectation.
What were his bread and butter issues?
He was basically a lot of the of the classic Republican agenda: low taxes, less regulation. He looked out for his thumb area district, and he was part of what was called the Republican Study Group, which was basically an effort to push conservative causes in Congress.
Some people turned on Paul Mitchell this week for pointing out that Joe Biden had clearly won the election. He was name-called in some quarters as a Republican in name only or a rhino. What kind of politician have you observed Paul Mitchell to be?
I've actually known him professionally for a while, and he, again, which is not unusual for business people who go into politics, is that he considers himself a common sense, can-do kind of person who thought that he could help break the mold of politics, and found out that maybe the mold is more powerful than his intentions.
Does that track in any way, do you think, with his statement that he's going to leave the Republican Party, and that the direction the party is taking under Donald Trump is perhaps, in his view, misguided?
Yeah, I guess there are two things that come to mind. And one of them is that, especially as a relative newbie in Congress, it's very hard to swim against the tide, that you're working with hundreds and hundreds of members of both parties. Majority can switch back and forth, as we've seen even during Paul Mitchell's time in Congress, and it can be difficult to make an individual impact if you're not willing to wait it out and rise in the ranks of seniority.
So it sounds like you were perhaps less than surprised at this news yesterday.
Well, usually what happens is if accomplished people decide that Congress isn't their thing, they just kind of throw up their hands, serve out their terms, and go home. In Paul Mitchell's case, he took the very unusual step of, before his term was over, making, in some respects, a symbolic statement and withdrawing from the Republican conference and having himself formally listed as an independent. And that got a lot of attention because it sends a message, and it sends a message to the Republican leadership that people like him are not happy with an unwillingness to play the game, I guess, in this respect, by the rules, that Donald Trump lost, even though Republicans didn't do that badly in the election, and the Republican leadership should push the president to make him understand that reality. I mean, that was the straw that broke the camel's back in this case.
As I mentioned, Paul Mitchell joins Justin Amash among Michigan Republicans who've left the party this year. I mean, two of the state's seven conservative congressmen. A third, Fred Upton, has never shied away from being critical of the president. What does all this say about Michigan's conservative politics right now?
Well, Fred Upton has always considered himself as hovering in that arena between moderate and conservative. And he's part of what's known as the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is bipartisan. And their idea is to find places where politicians, either conservative versus progressive, within the caucus, within the conferences, or going across the aisle, to find issues where they can actually make things happen, rather than just debate from one side to the other side without getting much done. And so that's kind of the, you know, Upton position that in the case of Justin Amash, that he came in to push the party, the Republican Party and the Congress in a more libertarian direction. And I think somewhat like Paul Mitchell, found his ambitions thwarted by the power of the conference system in Congress. And then, you know, Paul Mitchell, again, the same thing, that, you know, he wanted to find some places to get things done and wound up with the same level of frustration, which in the end kind of is something more than a symbolic measure. He sent a message by saying, look, I'm not even going to consider myself a Republican anymore if this is the way that the Republican leadership is going to change, is going to behave when, you know, the election is settled, by all accounts.
Rick Pluta covers politics for Michigan's public radio stations. Rick, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, April.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Bear. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.